everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and write us a review.
But only if it's a good one.
So we're back after a short little break. Life has been lifing, and unfortunately we had to take a little break.
Your life has been, but mine's just been on hold waiting for you to come back.
And I'm back, so we're back.
We're back.
Murder, Mother and Me is back.
In the meantime, we did a bit of research, didn't we?
In the meantime, so for Mother's Day, I bought my mum tickets to go and see a live stage show called Making a Murderer 2. And it was with a famous police detective called Colin Sutton. So for those of you that don't know, Colin Sutton is quite well known for catching two prolific criminals, one being a guy called Delroy Grant, who I'd never heard of, but Mum, you seem to think you knew who he was.
The reason I'd heard of him was because I'd watched the dramatisation of that particular case on ITV, in which Martin Clunes played Colin Sutton, so...
Yeah, and that series, Manhunt, is basically based on the two most famous cases which Colin Sutton was involved with, which is what we've just said, Delroy Grant, and another one called Levi Belfield, which I'm sure most of you have heard of if you're interested in true crime. And I found it really interesting when Colin was talking on stage. He spoke about other stuff as well, but the main two that he spoke about were Delroy Grant and Levi Belfield. But I just found it interesting how much detail he went into from like personal experience as well, because obviously he was heading both of those cases. And he was telling like information, you know, that's not that well known to the public, and I find stuff like that really interesting.
Yeah, I think just to explain that, the first half of the show was two sort of unknown, relatively unknown cases that he dealt with, probably more as a younger policeman, and then as he sort of rose through the ranks, the second two was, one was the prolific sort of rapist, wasn't he, and the other one was turned out to be a serial killer in the end. His most famous victim, I think the name that people remember most is Millie Dowler, isn't it, and that's how he got caught, really. But Colin didn't give up, did he? And he got both of them.
No, well, I was looking for a Mother's Day present and I couldn't think of what to get. So I literally just randomly Googled true crime shows in the UK and I happened to come across this Making a Murderer 2 and I thought, oh, that looks interesting. But I didn't have very high hopes for it because I thought, who's even going to go to stuff like that? But you know what? I was really, really pleasantly surprised.
I like the way the Mother's Day present always involves you. You benefit from it as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a present for me, really, as well.
It wasn't like a foot spa like you normally get me or some weird kitchen gadget that I never use that ends up going in the bin. But you actually got something useful this.
Yeah, and we had a really good time, didn't we? It was actually, do you know what? It was a good mix of like serious topics, but also he made it quite humorous as well.
I'd recommend the show because he's very good at recounting the stories, isn't he, as well?
Yeah, he was a really good storyteller.
He's got a good sense of humour, a sort of wry sense of humour, you know, kept having little digs in at all the police force and things. It was funny, really.
It was really funny, yeah. So if you can, and you're interested in stuff like this like we are, get yourself to see Making a Murderer 2, because you won't be disappointed.
And then at the end, good old Carl did a meet and greet, and we were first in the queue. And he's lovely, isn't he? He's just a really nice man.
Yeah, so he seems really genuine and down to earth. And we liked it so much, to be honest, that my mum's booked us tickets to go and see him again.
To go and see the same show again. And I'm going to buy his book, which I think I might have upstairs anyway already, but I'm going to get him to sign it. So, and I think we'll go and see his second tour, isn't it? So I think we'll go and see a third one. And we're also thinking of going to CrimeCon, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to try and do CrimeCon this year, so very much looking forward to that.
Which
as
is
well.
Like a sort of weekend event or a few days event, isn't it, where they bring in people from the US and everything, isn't it? You know, people with true crime podcasts.
Well, it's just all things true crime, isn't it?
Just everything, yeah. So you can go around the stalls, you know, buy yourself some souvenirs.
We're going off on a mad one here, so let's get on with this week's episode.
This week, we're talking about an unsolved murder that happened way back in 1947. This is the infamous case of the Black Dahlia. Beneath the glittering surface of 1940s Los Angeles lay a darker world, a world of corruption, desperation, and unsolved crimes. But no mystery has haunted this city more than the brutal murder of Elizabeth Short, a young woman whose life was cut abruptly and whose name became forever entwined with a chilling nickname, the Black Dahlia. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Elizabeth Short was born on July the 29th, 1924, in Hyde Park, Massachusetts, the third of five daughters to Cleo and Phoebe Short. Her father abandoned the family during the Great Depression, staging his own suicide and vanishing. Her mother struggled to make ends meet, and Elizabeth was forced to grow quickly. Beth, as friends called her, was beautiful, with striking black hair, alabaster skin, and a touch of mystery. By her teens, she had already developed a deep love for film. Her dream? To become an actress. Like many before her, Elizabeth saw Hollywood as the promised land.
Can I just ask, what the hell is alabaster skin?
It's very white, isn't it? And it's like porcelain.
Sounds alabaster. Like a skin condition.
No, that's albino, I think. Oh, you're thinking of.
Yeah, but alabaster sounds like that as well. And also...
It also sounds like alopecia, so it could be... Maybe that's what you're
maybe
thinking
of. Maybe I'm mixing it up. But don't you think it's weird that there's places that are the same name as other places in different places in the world? Like, what, there's like a Hyde Park, Park,
yeah,
in
there's
Massachusetts.
But there's a Liverpool and a Manchester and everything in America, isn't there? So
that blows my mind. That, could they not think of something different?
Well, there's all... Well, it's a big world, isn't it? You know, they run out of things eventually. And also, there's loads of street names the same as well. If you go to this city, you know, there's like maybe Bold Street. And in another city, maybe not far away, there's another one, isn't there? So, by 1946, at just 22 years old, Elizabeth had bounced between cities. Florida, Boston, Santa Barbara, and finally Los Angeles. She was often seen with servicemen, drawn to the image of strength and stability. But she was not, as the tabloids would later imply, promiscuous or naive. She was searching for love, for security, for purpose. But instead of fame, she found herself struggling to survive, sleeping on couches and relying on acquaintances. She was broke, vulnerable, and in the city of angels, that can be dangerous.
Sounds like, you know, the entertainment industry has not changed in almost over 100 years.
Do you think it's the same now? Because
well, it is the same. I can tell you that from first-hand experiences.
Are you talking about in this country or in America? Or?
I'm just talking about the entertainment industry in general, yeah.
I think that's the way it works. I think for, you know, the dance industry and musicians, because I know some that I've spoken to about it, that, you know, they end up sleeping on people's sofas all the time and living with people they barely know, and they buy those cheap noodles and things and just live like that all of the time, hoping for a big break. And that's definitely what it was like back then with Hollywood.
Well, it's still a bit like that now. And even if you go back, I don't know, 10, 15 years when I was first starting out, I was always sleeping on friends' couches and stuff, trying to save a bit of money wherever I could and trying to break into the industry. It's not changed at all.
I think particularly at that time, every pretty young woman thought they were going to make it big in Hollywood and were just, you know, hoping for a chance to do that, and that's the way it worked.
Well, I can relate with Elizabeth, but not the being a pretty girl trying to break into the industry, but I can relate to the hustle and the struggle of trying to do that.
It was just after 10 a.m. on the morning of January the 15th, 1947, in the quiet neighbourhood of Lima Park, nestled just south of downtown. A woman named Betty Bersinger walked along Norton Avenue with her three-year-old daughter. Betty's mind was on errands, perhaps breakfast, perhaps just enjoying the rare time alone with her child. But as she approached a vacant lot on the west side of the street, just south of 39th Street, she noticed something peculiar lying in the grass. At first glance, she thought it was a store mannequin, pale, still, and posed unnaturally. She squinted. Then came the sickening realisation. It wasn't a mannequin at all. It was the body of a young woman, severed cleanly in half at the waist, her torso placed above her lower half with grotesque deliberation. The body was laid out with the arms raised above the head in a theatrical pose. The legs were spread wide apart, creating a deeply unsettling symmetry. The skin was so pale, so shockingly white, it appeared almost porcelain. And then there was the face. Carved into a grisly, permanent smile, the victim's mouth had been slashed from ear to ear, creating a grotesque effect known as a Glasgow smile. There were deep lacerations on her body, marks of blunt force trauma and evidence of torture, bruises, cuts and burns. Her body had been completely drained of blood, indicating she'd been killed elsewhere and transported to the lot post-mortem. Not a single drop of blood was found at the scene. It was clear. This murder had been done with clinical precision. The body had been washed, scrubbed clean with a chemical, believed to be gasoline, to remove any trace of fingerprints, bodily fluids or DNA. The positioning of the body was theatrical, almost ritualistic, as if the killer wanted their work to be found and feared. Betty ran to the nearest house and called the LAPD. The police arrived within minutes, followed closely by the press, who had police scanners and informants of their own. And what they saw horrified even the most seasoned homicide detectives. This was not just a murder, it was a message. The victim, they would soon learn, was 22-year-old Elizabeth Short, a struggling actress, a dreamer, a woman who had spent her last days adrift in the sprawl of Los Angeles.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, isn't there?
Well, I've read an awful lot of books and, you know, things about murder and stuff, and I think this is one of the worst ones I've ever read. I actually read this book flying on holiday somewhere. I was unprepared because what they'd done is they'd released the photographs of her body, the way it was found, and also in the when they were doing the post-mortem.
You can actually see pictures of it?
Oh, you can see them online. Do you want to have a quick look and then we'll come back?
Oh, go on then.
Oh, it's terrible.
Okay, I've just seen the picture, and to be honest, I don't even find it gruesome because it actually does look fake. Like, it doesn't look like a real human body.
Do you know what it kind of reminds me of? You know that alien autopsy video? Have you ever seen it where they show the alien during the autopsy and they're saying it's true, but no one really knows if it is? It looks like that, doesn't it? I think because the body's been drained of blood
It doesn't look like a real body. I can fully understand why this woman that was walking past thought it was a mannequin at first glance because...
You wouldn't be expecting to see it, and your mind jumps to the most obvious situation, doesn't it? Like someone's dumped something there and it's like not
real. Well,
your
brain probably thinks there's no way that can be a real body, so it must be a mannequin.
Yeah, because your eyes are seeing it, but your brain interprets it as the best possible scenario, I think.
Right, so let me go back a little bit here because I need to make sense of this. Obviously, I've heard of the Black Dahlia, but I've never actually, you know, looked into the case properly or heard all the details. So it's quite shocking, really, isn't it? It sounds to me just from the off here that she has been treated like an animal, like she's been hunted. That's what it feels like to me. You know, like when you hunt an animal and they hang it up and they gut it and they let it bleed and they get rid of all the blood out of it. And that's what it sounds like. And then
I think that's actually what was done because I think when they did the autopsy and everything, when they found the body, they think she's been sat in a bath or strung up in a bath, and rigor mortis set in that position. Do you know what I mean? Because the parts didn't perfectly align, and if you see the autopsy photographs when they did the post-mortem, they don't match. One's higher than the other, so she was in a weird angle, so they think she's being hung up maybe by wrists or upside down, whichever way, I don't know, and she was half in the bath and half out, something like that anyway.
So are they saying her body was actually cut in half after she'd already died or been killed?
I think that's probably the most likely thing because the blood was drained from the body, so I'm not sure if from the post-mortem they could tell. You know, normally they can tell by the skin stuff. I think it was actually afterwards.
And then my next question would be, is that why they bled the body? To be able to cut it in half without making a mess?
Could be a possibility, I suppose, that the body was cut in half for transportation as well, to make it easier to...
I don't know, it feels a little bit more deliberate than that to me. It doesn't feel like it was for ease, it feels like it was for a statement.
Well, I don't suppose it would make much difference, really. They could probably fold you in half, couldn't they? But the way she was laid out with the body parts, they weren't together, there was a gap, I think, of about 12 inches, 8 inches, something like that. They were going for the most horrific scene they could possibly...
Well, they succeeded, if you ask me, because I was just going to say, even like the staging of her body and the way her arms were positioned and her legs were wide open and stuff, it's like, it's that humiliation thing again, isn't it?
Yeah, it was on display. It was a statement, wasn't it?
Doesn't feel like we're not even into the story really, but to me already, it doesn't feel like a random attack or anything. It feels really personal. To do that much to someone, I mean, it's enough to kill someone, isn't it, to take their life, but to do all of this to them as well, I don't know. Is it just like a... Yeah, like a statement, like, for the press.
The strange thing about it is, though, that there was no similar murders, I don't think, after this. So if somebody was sending that message out, what was that message for then, if they weren't going to do it again? If they wanted to frighten people, you know, why did they not go on to do a second one and a third one, like the Zodiac Killer did? You know, there was a particular way he went about it and sent letters and things, you know. So if they were sending a message out, what was the purpose of that message then, if it was just a random one-off thing?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think it was random. I think it feels really personal. It's probably a bit of both, in my opinion. It had to have been something to do with her specifically. If there was nothing after and nothing before of this kind of thing, it had to have something to do with her and someone wanting to humiliate her or hurt her for some reason. I'm guessing that's still unknown, but even like that Glasgow smile, it's awful. Like they split your cheeks in half.
Yeah,
like,
they put a knife into your mouth and push it right back.
It's just horrendous. So, I've never.
It's like the Joker, isn't it? That's where that comes from.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, to inflict that level of callousness on someone, I don't know. It feels very personal.
And also take into account the fact that where the body was left as well, it was left on like a vacant lot, which houses were later built on. And it was literally feet away from the sidewalk. So a car would have had to have pull up there to get that body out and do that. And it was quite sort of open from what I can see from the pictures. So they took a real chance, didn't they? I think somebody saw the car but didn't realise what was going on. But that level of daring, do you know what I mean? To actually put the car there and then put a body.
It's confidence as well, isn't it?
Yeah, but a body that's been cut in half and laying on the grass knowing that somebody could come along. It's just bizarre.
I think there's also a reason why they put the body where they put it as well, because they obviously wanted it to be found.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh,
pinch. They did want it to be found, though. Otherwise, you'd go and hide it somewhere, wouldn't you? That's what I mean. Like, it's something to do with her and wanting her, like, to... Well, I guess in a weird way, she did become famous like she wanted, didn't she? But not in the way she wanted.
That's the sad thing about it. And she was only a very young woman, wasn't she?
But it seems like they wanted her to be on show for some reason.
I mean, when you look at the photos of her, she was pretty, but I always thought she was older than that. I thought she was probably about 28, 29, but she was only 22, and
she's
that's
still
really
a baby,
young.
Isn't she? Yeah, but even when it says here, like, you know, the body had been washed, scrubbed clean with chemicals, potentially gasoline. I've never heard of anyone scrubbing a body with gasoline, first of all.
Well, it's used to remove fingerprints.
Well, yeah, exactly, but it's someone that knows what they're doing.
It's somebody who's probably... I mean, was that gasoline purchased with that in mind, or was it a case of something they already had in the house? Or
it sounds like it was planned, because when it's saying like the body was severed with clinical precision and stuff like that, this is not something that's just...
You'd need the correct tools to do
fly,
that, wouldn't
you?
Yeah.
And it's not like a botched job where they've been hacking at it with a machete or something, trying to get a body in half.
So like maybe like it wasn't like someone kidnapped her and thought, oh, and strangled her or something, and then thought, what am I going to do? No. They actually had all the right tools, didn't they, and the stuff.
I think they'd planned to do exactly what they've done.
So they drained the blood, washed her body, cut her up. And then this smile is the Glasgow smile is the thing for me, because that's just an extra thing that you really wouldn't need to do.
It's a statement.
It's like a hatred thing, isn't it? They've disfigured her as much as she could. And as you said, humiliated her as much as she could, as they could, by just laying her there in where the public go past every day. They didn't try to hide her. She was literally put there on purpose. News spread like wildfire. Reporters swarmed the lot, climbing over each other to get a better look. Some even tampered with the scene. Footprints were erased, tire tracks trampled, potential evidence contaminated. And amid the chaos, one detail stood out to all who saw her. The beauty and brutality side by side. The stark contrast of Elizabeth's youthful face with the violence inflicted upon her became an enduring, chilling image. The question began to form, who could do something like this and why? The press descended upon the crime scene like vultures, eager to feast on the grisly details. Within hours, headlines screamed of a Hollywood starlet slain and gruesome murder shock city, but it was the moniker, the Black Dahlia, that would etch itself into true crime history. The nickname, a morbid twist on the 1946 film The Blue Dahlia, was reportedly coined by newsroom staff at the Los Angeles Herald Express. Elizabeth Short's penchant for black attire and her striking dark hair made the comparison irresistible to sensationalist journalists. But the media's portrayal of Elizabeth went beyond a catchy nickname. They painted her as a femme fatale, a seductress who led a double life. Tabloids speculated about her alleged promiscuity, her supposed involvement in underground activities, and her aspirations for stardom. Much of this was unfounded, yet it shaped public perception. In reality, Elizabeth was a young woman navigating the challenges of post-war America. She held various jobs, struggled financially, and harboured dreams of making it big in Hollywood. Friends described her as polite, soft-spoken, and somewhat reserved. The media's narrative, however, overshadowed these truths, transforming her into a symbol of the era's anxieties and obsessions.
Well, I think, you know, back in those days, in the 1940s, I guess people, I mean, even now, people believe whatever they read in the press, don't they? They can say whatever they want and people believe it.
It's like, it was on telly, so it's true, or it was in the paper and it was true.
Or if the press said that Elizabeth was a bit promiscuous and a prostitute, in no other words, she must be. Why would they say that if she wasn't?
Yeah. So at that time, the way she dressed, although it wasn't particularly provocative, it gave her an air of mystery, and that could be perceived as something else. And also at that time as well, young starlets and people, like we were saying before, trying to make it in the industry, they'd very often go out with men just so they pay for the dinner for them, so they could have food. And then that can be misconstrued again as a girl being, you know, easy, for want of a better word. So
even the way, like, the crime scene's handled and stuff, again, we're back in 1940s here, so I guess things were handled completely differently, like letting the media trample all over the crime scene. And even the pictures that I've just saw online, they're so close to the body. The media, they should never be allowed to get that close to the crime scene. So even that in itself, like it said, you know, footprints were erased, tire tracks were potentially erased. It's a completely contaminated crime scene now. And, you know, with all the new technology and stuff that we know we have now, maybe if they would have had something better back then to get, you know, samples and stuff, we might have an answer.
I don't think, to be honest, the way the body was washed down and everything else and drained, I don't think they would have got much.
Well, they probably wouldn't have got any evidence from the body.
They might have found, like, a loose hair
That's
or something.
That's what I mean, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Or a footprint or anything, you know. They can catch anyone from anything now,
well,
can't
somebody
they?
Somebody put that body there. They got it out the car and put it there. So there would have been footprints, but they were all trampled over.
But it sounds like, you know, the police have just let the media run wild with this. They're not even trying to contain it.
And I think members of the public were going past and looking
as
well.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
Everyone was.
Thank God they didn't have iPhones back then.
Rubbernecking to get a better look, you know, and they were pushing each other out of the way. And the fact that the press were allowed to take photographs is really.
I know, it sounds like, well, that's just really degrading, number one, isn't it? But also, it's like she wasn't even allowed to have any dignity, even in death. People were all crowding around her, taking photos of her.
I think they eventually put a blanket over her or something, but, you know, it was a bit like them, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the police probably could have handled that a bit better, and it sounds like it became like a media frenzy within, you know, a couple of hours.
Well, you've got to remember as well that all of those newspapers were, you know, they all want their headline, don't they? As they still do now, but, and they're all fighting for it, aren't they? And this was like a really big thing, wasn't it? And it was a really, really bad murder, you know?
Well, I can imagine back then, was there even phones in 1940? I'm guessing
yes,
no.
Yes,
yeah, there was. Okay, but not one where you could just pick it up and call someone straight away. So
no, they had to run to a telephone
box. That's what I'm saying.
Box,
I'm
imagining
imagine
them all running down the
yeah, they're fighting over getting to the phone box.
The photographers had those big cameras, you know, yeah, big flash bulbs on everything.
Or
but
they're
we're
all
laughing.
Running.
It's not even funny,
no,
is it?
No, they're all running trying to get back to the office first.
That's
so that
what
they can
like,
be the first
yeah.
one to print. So
to phone in the story, that's what they did.
Yeah.
No mobiles then, imagine. So, I mean, the thing is, if there had have been mobiles and it people had got there first, that would have been all over social media, wouldn't it? All pictures of her then, so it would have been even worse. The Los Angeles Police Department faced immense pressure to solve the Black Dahlia case. The brutality of the murder, combined with the media frenzy, demanded swift action. Yet the investigation would become one of the most extensive and perplexing in the city's history. Detectives interviewed over 150 suspects and received more than 60 confessions, many of which were quickly dismissed. I mean, that's
60
weird.
Confessions.
I mean, that's your claim to fame, isn't it? Butchering a girl and leaving her out in a weedy lot, you know? If that's the best you can come up with in life, you might as well just give up.
Well, that probably comes from as well it being such a massive story at the time that psychopaths would want to be, you know, associated with it.
I just don't get that mentality to you. Hello, let's, just so that my name is recognised, let's go and spend the rest of my life in prison. The lack of physical evidence at the crime scene posed significant challenges. The body had been meticulously cleaned and the area showed no signs of struggle or blood, indicating that Elizabeth had been killed elsewhere. On January the 24th, 1947, a chilling development occurred. The Los Angeles Examiner received a package containing Elizabeth's personal belongings, her birth certificate, business cards, photographs, and an address book with several pages missing. Accompanying these items was a note composed of letters cut from newspapers reading, "Here is Dahlia's belongings, letter to follow." The sender identified themselves as the Black Dahlia Avenger. This taunting communication intensified the investigation. The LAPD, in collaboration with the FBI, analysed the materials for fingerprints and other clues. While partial prints were recovered, they did not match any in existing databases. The meticulous nature of the crime and the subsequent correspondence suggested a perpetrator with a deep understanding of forensic procedures and a desire for notoriety.
I was literally just going to say that. It's definitely someone that understands forensics, or like someone that understands, I was going to say cleaning products, but a cleaner could understand that. But you know what I mean? It's someone that understands if they wash this body properly, there's no way anyone can ever find out who they are.
Yeah. And see what you've just done there, though. You've just said whoever it was, as in like a singular person. But this could have actually been more than one person, couldn't it, I think?
It could have been. I just always assume it's one person.
I think that's just what comes to mind, but I don't know. I've just got a feeling it was more than one person.
And again, it sounds planned. Like, why would you take all of her belongings? And also, is it not a bit bizarre that they had her birth certificate? They had her birth certificate, business cards, photographs, and her address book. Is that all stuff that she would be carrying on her person?
I think maybe at that time, they had to do that. You know, don't forget she was living in, like, sort of like hostel situations and on friends, you know, spare rooms and things in their spare rooms and on sofas and things. So
yeah, so she probably carried
maybe her personal belongings, but just in a bag, and she just kept them all the time. And it was post-war, so maybe they needed to do that for some reason. I'm not really
sure. For identification or something?
Yeah, something like that.
It's also like the kind of confidence in the fact that they know that they're not going to be caught. Do you know what I mean? By taunting the police like that, by sending her stuff in, calling themselves, you know, the Black Dahlia Avenger. Like, that's such
what
a random title to give yourself.
The Black Dahlia Avenger sounds like somebody
who's trying to avenge the death.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, what, that doesn't really make sense, does it? But
it doesn't.
Then Black Dahlia Avenger, maybe it's against her, you know what I mean?
But it's a little bit like the Zodiac, isn't it? In terms
that's
of sending stuff to
say.
The press to kind of taunt them a little bit.
That's what I was saying before. It's similar, isn't it? Because, but Zodiac went on to do a number of crimes. That's why I don't understand why this was just one. Maybe the intention was there to do others, and maybe I was going to say it caused too much of a, you know, a spectacle sort
yeah,
of thing
in the press.
Yeah, it was
too hot to do anything else.
But yeah, but then that's what they obviously wanted, though. So I don't really know whether that was the intention or.
And I also just don't really see the relevance or the purpose in them sending her belongings to the police either. Like, I just don't really get that. What's the point?
Well,
was it just to taunt them to
say? Like you say, the Zodiac did it, Jack the Ripper did it.
Yeah.
And probably a number of other people as well. So it's
it feels to me like it's just a bit of a.
It's like they want to send them clues. It's like taunting them.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It?
Like, it's a bit of an
effort. Yorkshire
Ripper
did the same thing as well. Well, it turned out not to be him, didn't it?
here I am with your. You know, here I am. I've got her stuff. And you don't know who I am. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And as it happens, nothing. Because
they
haven't found
them. They kind of string it out, don't they? Longer to get more attention. And it's like, it does something for them, doesn't it?
But yeah, I can't help but feel like it's definitely someone that has some kind of understanding of maybe even like police work or something. They understand how to not get caught.
Also, though, you notice that they said that she was meticulously dissected, really.
Could that just be someone with severe OCD?
No, I think you'd have to know a body.
That's what I mean. Like,
okay, let's just say now, you know, we murdered somebody, right?
We'd be terrible.
We've not, by the way, but if we did.
Or is that some what
okay,
you'd say if you did?
We're going to, maybe, yeah. If we're going to cut it off, okay, it's a bit of reverse psychology there, you see. If we cut it off, would you know how to do that? Because I
wouldn't. Not a clue.
Not that I'd want to, but I'm saying
I would honestly
a place,
just go
it?
With, like, literally just trying to cut it in off.
But that's what I'm saying. There's a certain place, isn't there? In the vertebrae and different things where you is the easiest part to do it. And whoever did it knew that, though. You could tell that they knew it.
Yeah, well, it said everything was cut with precision and stuff.
Yeah,
so they definitely know the way around the body, number one. And
you're
they definitely know forensics.
They've not just got some old like bread knife out the drawer and done it. They've done it with proper tools.
Yeah, it sounds like a scalpel or something, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but more than that, though, they've known how to do it. So
yeah.
That's the key for me.
That's very telling, isn't it, actually? That's probably the biggest piece of evidence without it being, like,
well,
concrete
I think
evidence.
That's what would steer in the direction of people. It's not going to just be, like, the local garbage man down the road, is it? Or, you know.
Or someone that works in KFC.
Yeah, or, you know, Morrison's. Unless they worked in the meat department. But no, they wouldn't, would they? Your average person wouldn't know how to do it. So it's got to be someone who's got some anatomical skill. Over the decades, numerous theories have emerged regarding the identity of the Black Dahlia's killer. While many suspects were considered, three individuals have garnered particular attention due to compelling, albeit circumstantial, evidence. Number one, Dr. George Hodel. A prominent physician in Los Angeles, Dr. Hodel became a prime suspect years after the murder. His own son, Steve Hodell, a former LAPD detective, conducted an independent investigation uncovering disturbing connections. Steve discovered that his father had a history of sexual misconduct, including allegations of incest, and had been previously investigated for the Black Dahlia murder. Audio recordings from 1949, obtained through a police wiretap, captured Dr. Hodell making incriminating statements, including, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they couldn't prove it now." Additionally, Dr. Hodell's medical expertise aligned with the precise surgical mutilation observed on Elizabeth's body. Number 2, Leslie Dillon. A bellhop and aspiring writer, Dillon became a suspect after engaging in correspondence with LAPD psychiatrist Dr. J. Paul DeRiver. Dillon displayed an unusual interest in the case and provided detailed theories about the murder. Under intense questioning, he implicated a friend and also revealed knowledge that had not been made public. However, inconsistencies in his statements and a lack of concrete evidence led to his release. Number 3, Walter Bailey. Dr. Bailey, a respected surgeon, lived near the location where Elizabeth's body was discovered. Some researchers have speculated that his medical background and proximity to the crime scene made him a plausible suspect. However, there is no direct evidence linking him to the murder, and he was never formally charged. Each of these suspects presents intriguing possibilities, yet none have been definitively proven to be the Black Dahlia's killer. The case remains open, a haunting reminder of justice unfulfilled.
Right, well, for me, number 2, Leslie Dillon, he can go away. It's definitely not him.
Well,
without a shadow of a doubt.
Well, we need to just have a little look,
well,
don't
a
we?
Bellhop, aspiring writer, none of his details made sense. There was loads of inconsistencies. He displayed an unusual interest in the case.
I know, well, we
so
could,
what?
We
we're displaying an unusual interest in the case.
That's what I was thinking.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that to me...
Yeah, but just say there, though, he implicates a friend but revealed knowledge that had not been made public. So how did he get that then?
Well...
He might have known somebody in the press or something.
Yeah, that could have meant anything, couldn't it? So, for me, Leslie Dillon, it's not you. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. So, for me, it's between Dr. George Hodell and Dr. Walter Bailey.
And that's because they've both got that medical background, isn't it?
Well, it has to be, because like we've just said before, it had to have been someone that had some level of education
expertise
or experience in surgery or... Yeah, dissection or something. It has to be. You wouldn't be able to cut a body that precisely without knowledge, like you said. So
Walter Bailey, he lived near the location where the body was discovered. But
well, that would be a red flag for me in the opposite direction. That to me says more that it's probably not him, because I don't think you'd be that stupid. If you're smart enough to be a surgeon, I don't think you're stupid enough.
And you're smart enough to remove fingerprints and that.
Yeah.
And especially if you're pulling up in a car, wouldn't the neighbours recognise
exactly.
you?
Exactly. You know, I don't think you're then dumb enough to put a body outside your house.
Yeah, unless, though, it was done by more than one person and he did the actual handiwork, but someone else dropped the body off. And it could be that.
All right, I see where you're going with that. So you're saying someone could have done the surgical stuff and someone else could have...
Yeah, because I personally think there's more than one person involved in this. I don't know why. I've read the book and it's a while ago now, but to me it makes more sense. Just the way she was strung up and everything and all of that, you know.
Well, we don't know that for definite, do we? But,
well, we do, because she was drained of blood and it was the way she was...
Well, I guess there's only one way to drain you of blood, really, isn't there, properly?
Yeah. You'd need to sort of hang it, really, wouldn't you, so the body. So that's definitely being done.
I personally think it was... One person. I think one person could have done this. It doesn't seem implausible to me that one person couldn't handle it.
No, I never said that it couldn't. It wasn't plausible, but for me, it's more likely, I think, to have been more than one person. And if it was, then, and I've got no anything to support that, but if it was, you know, you could have had some sort of surgeon, and, you know, they're quite probably well-to-do, aren't they? Who doesn't want to be involved, you know, do the dirty work kind of thing of jumping the body and things, because so they didn't get caught. I don't know. Anyway, it just makes sense to me.
That to me, it rings like, it's a little bit like, you know, if like, I don't know, mobsters or something, they get shot. They're not going to go to a normal hospital. They'll go to like a back alley doctor, won't they, where they'll do surgery.
Yeah,
it reminds me of that kind of
thing. But also, the top like mafia man isn't going to go and do it himself. He gets other people
to do it.
But
that's what I'm saying. So like, yeah. Maybe they've killed it themselves and they've took to someone else to get it dismembered or whatever.
So the fact that he lives in the neighbourhood, that actually might be a red flag, because it could be, I know, a convenient location where you can drop her off, because it's not that far from there, do you know what I mean? But I'm not doing it, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's all just supposition, isn't it? It's all just speculation, isn't it? But I, to me, the fact that the body was closer to his house, that seems like it wouldn't be him to me. So that leaves me with Dr. George Hodel. And I think for me, even the fact that his own son's investigating him, that says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, he's my number one suspect. Although, you know, probably even since then, there's been loads of people come forward and said, oh, my father was the Black Dahlia murderer. And also, you get it with the Zodiac as well. So people still come forward, or their grandfather or whatever, you know, they found old letters and things. And, you know, it could be something as innocuous as the photograph that looks like, and it's probably not even her, but they kind of put the dots together and it's not right. But we still don't know. But Dr. George Hodel was a prominent physician, as he said, and he worked with a lot of showbiz people. He did a lot of illegal abortions as well. So could it have been... I mean, that's another theory, you know, that maybe she was pregnant, maybe she went to him for an illegal abortion.
And he's just killed her.
And something's gone wrong, and then they've tried to disguise it by doing this. And the tendency is to go over the top to make it...
They've gone completely over the top.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how likely that is, but you know what I mean, don't you? Yeah. That they've gone a little bit too far, but
yeah,
it's made it...
Well, they've disguised what she actually
went for. So that they're not looking at any other sorts of theories about
it. Well, especially if maybe it was, I don't know, potentially known in the underground circuit that he does illegal abortions or something, then obviously if they'd found her and she wasn't so cut up and everything, and it was obvious that she'd been for an abortion and something had gone wrong, but maybe you'd be the first person you look at.
I think there's more to this story from what I can remember. I think his own daughter, I think, accused him of, like, molestation and things.
Well, it does say he had after his son had investigated him, he had a history of sexual misconduct and allegations of incest. So that obviously points towards family members.
I know that he had a lot of Hollywood parties go on. He threw Hollywood parties and things.
And we know what happens at those.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit like this whole Jeffrey thingy.
Epstein
thing, yeah. You know, it's like he knew people who were sort of high up in the police force in all different areas. And so, and also that's how he got away with illegal abortions as well. So what happens at these parties exactly? In you know, it's well known that Hollywood stars were brought in for like a number of different reasons, you know, for like sex shows, sleep with men, you know, that type of thing. Now, I'm not saying she did that, but that could be another possibility.
It's a possibility, yeah.
You know, so, you know, making movies, that was another theory that, you know, she went, because she was an aspiring actress, and, you know, they all start somewhere at the bottom, and it's notorious, isn't it, Hollywood, for the casting couch and all this, and it's like, well, if you do this, we'll get you into another film and stuff. But in actual fact, some of these films were what they call, you know, snuff films, where people were murdered on, you know, on film, and people paid good money to see that, which... still goes on today.
That's horrendous,
isn't
it?
And that terrifies me more than anything else, to be honest.
I think, yeah, my energy is firmly going towards him for one reason or another. I just think it says a lot when your own son, who is a police detective, is doing an independent investigation. Surely you'd just be like, oh, not my dad, not George. He'd never do that. You know what I mean?
But for me, he's got the expertise. He's got the background, the medical training and everything. He's got the right connections and he's in the right place. You know, he knew all of these people, you know.
He's in the same circle in a weird way, isn't he?
Yeah. So he could very well have come into contact with her.
And again, like, for all three of those suspects, it's all just speculation. There is no concrete evidence for either, all three of them.
This business about when he said, these incriminating statements where he said, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, and I think it was his secretary who's since died, hears him say that, they couldn't prove it. Now, I mean, that's something... I wouldn't say that was incriminating particularly.
Well, to be fair, he might be
talking about the case, and he might just...
I was going to say, he could have just been saying, they couldn't prove it anyway, so what does it matter if I did, exactly. You know what I mean? He could have just been saying a flippant comment, couldn't he?
The thing, when he says they couldn't prove it now, though, I'm thinking, does that indicate some knowledge... You know, that he knew the body was washed down.
I was just going to say, does it show that, like...
Or was that just commonly reported?
Yeah. Or, like, they're not going to be able to solve it because I know they're not going to be able to solve it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because I made sure they won't.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And he would have access to all of these things that he needed to do this.
Especially if you're saying he had friends in maybe high places and stuff. You don't know what goes on behind the scenes, do you?
Los Angeles in the 1940s was a city of contrasts. Beneath the glamour of Hollywood's golden age lurked a shadowy underworld of corruption, vice, and unspoken truths. The Black Dahlia case unfolded against this backdrop, revealing the city's darker facets. The LAPD, tasked with solving the murder, was itself under scrutiny. Allegations of corruption and incompetence plagued the department. Some believed that powerful individuals, possibly connected to the entertainment industry or local government, influenced the investigation's direction, hindering its progress. Moreover, the media's sensationalist coverage often blurred the lines between fact and fiction. Competing newspapers published conflicting accounts, sometimes compromising the integrity of the investigation. The public, enthralled by the lurid details, demanded answers, but the truth remained elusive. The Black Dahlia case became more than a homicide. It was a reflection of a city grappling with its identity, torn between the allure of fame and the reality of its moral complexities.
I think that just touched on really what we were just saying, doesn't it? Like, you don't know that people high up in the police department were not corrupt at that time, and maybe they did know the doctor, and they've kind of steered the direction of the investigation away from it to help him out.
This could be why they let everybody trample all over the scene
That's
well.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe it was intentional.
You know, it's like, well, let's blame it on that because we, you know, it's like Princess Diana, this, with the paparazzi following her, you know. Well, they knew that was a, if you believe that it was done on purpose, which I do believe it was done on purpose, you know, the paparazzi following her was a good cover story, you know, to explain her death, wasn't it? And it's kind of like that, I think, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because it's like, well, she wouldn't have been driving that fast if the paparazzi weren't following her and blah, blah, blah.
It was just like a perfect cover story, isn't it? Well, there's a history of that and it was going to happen sooner or later. And this, you know, well, I'll tell you what, let's not hold them back too much because then we can say, well, there isn't any evidence, you know, at all.
Oh, would you look at that? The crime scene's been trampled all over and now we've got no evidence.
The murder of Elizabeth Shaw transcended its time, embedding itself into the cultural fabric of America. Over the years, the Black Dahlia has inspired countless books, films, and artistic interpretations, each adding layers to the mythos. James Ellroy's novel, The Black Dahlia, and its subsequent film adaptation reimagined the case, blending fact with fiction. Documentaries and true crime series have revisited the murder, each offering new theories and perspectives. However, this continued fascination often obscures the real person at the heart of the story. Elizabeth Short, a young woman with dreams and aspirations, becomes a symbol, her humanity overshadowed by the mystery of her death. The enduring intrigue surrounding the Black Dahlia speaks to society's complex relationship with crime, beauty, and tragedy. It challenges us to consider how narratives are constructed and whose voices are amplified or silenced. Amid the speculation and sensationalism, it's essential to remember Elizabeth Short as more than a victim or a symbol. She was a daughter, a sister, and a friend. Elizabeth's life, though marked by hardship, was filled with hope and resilience. She saw connection, purpose, and a sense of belonging. Her tragic end should not define her. Instead, we should honour her memory by acknowledging her humanity. The Black Dahlia case remains one of the most haunting unsolved murders in American history. Decades have passed, yet the mystery endures, captivating new generations and prompting ongoing debates. But beyond the intrigue lies a poignant truth. A young woman's life was cut short, her dreams unfulfilled, her story co-opted by sensationalism. As we reflect on Elizabeth Short's life and death, let us strive to remember her not as a symbol of mystery, but as a person deserving of dignity and justice. So, is that not one of the worst cases you've ever heard?
Yeah, it's horrendous. And it's just bloody annoying, to be honest, because, again, we don't know who it is.
I mean, that case is far worse as well. There's a lot more to it than that, really, but I know we've got to condense it down just for this time.
I mean, we say that about every case, don't we? There's so much more you could go into, but we'd end up going off on a million different tangents.
But, you know, I was telling you prior to this that during the post-mortem they found many other things as well. It wasn't, you know, it was bad enough as it was, wasn't it? There was other horrific details that had been inflicted upon her.
She'd really suffered before she died.
She really, really had, yeah. And it was so brutal and so degrading and everything what they did to her.
And I think I've put this together in my head, and maybe this is just how I think it happened, but it kind of makes sense in my mind now that when I was saying at the beginning it felt personal, that maybe she's met this Dr. Hodel somewhere, because he's in the entertainment circle, and something's happened, I don't know what, and he's ended up killing her. And that's kind of the connection for me between the two. That's what makes sense in my mind. Why he would go as far as he went and do the horrific things that was done to her, I have no idea.
But you've got to look at the way she was presented after death. To me, it's all a big show. So therefore, to me, prior to that, it would be the same reason. Do you know what I mean? And the key word is show to me. I think it was done during some kind of weird Hollywood sex party, sex show, sex film, snuff film, that kind of thing. To me, that's what it is. The only other thing is what I said before, where it's been some kind of accident through an abortion maybe, and they've gone completely over the top
to disguise it,
so they wouldn't look at that option at all.
It's one of them cases, isn't it, where as horrific as it is, are we ever going to have an answer? Probably not. We're nearly 100 years on and there's still nothing.
I saw a film where it wasn't a film, it was a documentary film, and they showed you pictures of it. So sad, because, you know, she was only a young one. Probably at this point, she probably would have been about 20, and she was, or maybe even 22, the same age as when she died. But she's sitting outside like some kind of school building, and other various locations they have photos of her in. And they went back and they superimposed her image on the actual building. You could see it. You could see the exact step. It's all still there. And you just think, you know, there she was, full of life, just, you know. And now that when they superimposed this, you saw the real sort of buildings, you could see the step, and she's just no longer with us, you know, and for what reason?
Well, I think, like it was saying at the end there, you've got to remember that this is a young woman. She's a real person. This really happened, and she had a family, she had friends, she had a career, or she had a career that she wanted. She had dreams. And to die, not only to get murdered, but to die in that way as well.
I don't think she did anything wrong, you see. I don't think it was anything she did.
No, I don't think she did either.
I think, you know, when you're saying she was targeted, I think she was, but I think it was for a specific reason, and this reason was to do whatever I was saying before, which was a show-type situation. And the reason I think that as well is because George Hodel was affiliated to Hollywood and filmmaking, and he was already running one underground operation, which was illegal abortion. So therefore, why would he not be connected to some other illegal activities, such as black market filmmaking, for want of a better word? Do you know what I mean? You know, things like that couldn't be released in the mainstream, could they? So there's a specific market for that, and the specific market is normally influential people with money.
Yeah, because I'm sure they'll pay a lot of money to watch weird shit like that. Well, I think we're both in agreement that we think it was most likely Dr. George Hodel.
Yeah.
And potentially some other people that were involved in a crime ring or something.
Yeah, I couldn't see it just being some one-off nutcase who just decided to do this. It's too well
organised,
isn't it? Yeah.
Definitely.
So it's someone who knows what they're doing.
What a horrifying case. I like I said, I've heard of the Black Dahlia, because everyone interested in true crime has, but I've never actually heard the full, you know, the full details read out like that. Mm-hmm. So,
like you said, though, it's sad, really, because she wanted to be famous, and she's become infamous, and she is a sort of a mythical figure, you know. But she really was just a young woman who was just very kind of ordinary, really, trying to do what a lot of people were doing at that time after the war, make herself some money. She was nice looking, you know what I mean, and she just wanted to sort of try and cash in on that and get a life for herself. And ultimately, in doing so, she's lost her life.
Right, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.